We start things off with the Wintrust Business Lunch Hour. I'm Bob Surratt.
I'm Marianne Murciano.
And coming up, we will tell you how to make money by blogging, also what's hot in the social media department. And first, it's Frank Sennett with the Crane Chicago Business Headlines. And I always enjoy this issue, the best places to work in Chicago. Any big surprises here or common threads, Frank?
Yes. Check out the full array at chicagobusiness.com. A lot of great employers you might want to look at if you're looking for a career change. The thing that I took away from the best places to work list this year is that there's still a lot of fun and quirky perks, like, you know, scooters in the office or whatever. But when you drill down, you tend to see lots of kind of tangible things like flexible benefits, liberal work from home policies, unlimited vacation days. That's called getting fired, isn't it?
Wow. So what constitutes a best place to work? Is it those kinds of things, or is it the scooters in the office, which I didn't really know about?
Right, and ping pong. And I think it's more the substantive things that people really appreciate over the long term. If you look at the overall winner, a digital ad firm called Rocket Fuel with around 100 employees in Chicago. It's a national firm. They have free breakfast every day, gourmet lunches Monday through Thursday, so it's like being back in public school, basically. But they also offer more substantively a generous paid maternity and paternity leave, unlimited vacation, profit sharing. They used to provide warm chocolate chip cookies every day, but the employees voted to make a healthy choice and nix those last fall. But our reporter hears that there are very many regrets about that decision.
But aren't the things that matter more akin to like a 401k plan that they match, you know, your savings with, like, it used to be a long time ago? I mean,
yeah,
those are the things.
Absolutely. Profit sharing and, like I say, generous vacation and work from home policies, flex scheduling. Those are the things you're really seeing, these kind of long term things that anchor you to an employer, make you feel very loyal as compared to, you know, but there are employers that have the fun stuff too. Radio Flyer, one of the winners. They have Take Your Kids to Work Day program where kids come in and test the products there. So, you know, good for that place. IT services firm EMC, 3 days per year paid charity work. So you can take, you know, 3 days off and do some good, some charity.
What I notice about this list of the best workplaces is that the amount of employees that they have are usually like 50-something.
A lot of smaller employers.
Companies.
Yeah, yeah. It's harder because, I mean, if you look at some of these perks, LaSalle Network, the staffing firm, they take employees on an annual trip to places like Napa Valley and Miami Beach. Pretty tough if you're like Sears or something, you know,
right,
or United Airlines.
But and you you guys at Cranes now broke this down according to the employee age groups. Is that what you did?
Yeah, so the top workplace for millennials, everybody's always fascinated, what do the youngsters want, right? Software and engineering consultancy DMC is the top winner for millennials. There's an annual company ski trip, that's fun, and there's a monthly activity fund of nearly $3,000, which I'd like to be in charge of. But the more substantive thing for the millennials is, you know, they're looking for career growth. So there's a mentoring program in place there, and then they have weekly lunch and learns to expand the skill set. So they're really trying to, you know, deal with that younger cohort that's looking for career advancement and help.
And, you know, whether you're talking about the best workplaces for the Gen X folks or millennials or anybody, in the old days, people looked for a place that maybe they could spend their lifetime at. You get the gold watch after 25 years or whatever. That's gone now. So we're looking for these other things, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the meantime, if you can get profit sharing now instead of maybe the long-term 30-year investment, might make more sense for people. I agree that compact is very different now between employers and employees.
Let's talk about another trend Crane Chicago Business is covering, the invasion of the quick-fired pizza. Now, we had Larry Levy on the broadcast not too long ago talking about Blaze. They're popping up everywhere. Is this a story about many businesses like that coming to Chicago?
Absolutely. So Blaze kicked off this market category in Chicago at the end of 2013. But this year, there are going to be at least six chains that are going to enter the same market. And it's the Chipotle version of pizza. You go in, pick your ingredients and your crust type, and in under 5 minutes, they get it to you, very high heat, thin crust. And so basically, they're creating a new market segment that, again, as you say, Blaze kind of pioneered. They've got some of them coming in, Seattle-based Mod Superfast Pizza. They're going to be opening 6 outlets in the suburbs. Uncle Matteo's, an Atlanta-based chain, has 34 restaurants headed this way. 800 Degrees Neapolitan Pizza has its first Illinois restaurant opening this summer in Evanston. And it's also looking around the Loop and River North. So maybe we'll, you know, do that after the show one day, go get a quick pizza. So basically, well, yeah, you know, they're going to be popping up all over the place.
Marianne has given her, you know, they used to have the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. Now we have the Marianne seal of approval on certain foods. And she's given Blaze her stamp.
Good that stuff. Means I eat it.
Yeah. It must be kind of healthy.
That sounds
well,
good.
Well, I love that it's really thin. So yeah, you don't feel like crust. You're getting a ton of bread.
Yeah, not a lot of carbs like with the stuffed crust
right.
in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's paper thin. I love that.
Let's talk a little bit about Chicago's tourism team and also a new biography of Michelle Obama. We'll do that with Frank Sennett from Cranes right after a quick break. Continuing with this week's Crane Chicago Business Headlines and Frank Sennett, Chicago's tourism team has a money issue. That's the headline. What's the story?
Well, basically, the value of the dollar has gone up internationally, and I don't know if, you know, my friends are talking about, my colleagues, yours as well, probably it's cheap to go to Europe right now. It's almost 1-to-1 against the euro. But the bad consequence of it is that maybe fewer international travelers coming to Chicago in the next couple of years because it's just too expensive for them. So there are already plans afoot to kind of deal with this in Chicago. Hyatt, Chicago-based hotel chain, told investors in February that earnings are going to take a hit for the first 3 quarters of this year due to the dollar's strength. More outward-looking, Choose Chicago, which markets the city to the world, has closed several offices in Europe and is really focusing on China. They've taken the marketing budget and taken it from the UK, where the pound has dropped more than 10% against the dollar in the past year, and the rest of Europe, and they're shifting it over to its fourth China office just opened. So they're really putting money into China. Hopefully that will turn it around. But worst thing comes to worst, international travel only accounts for about 5% of the visits to Chicago. So we're hoping that a lot of domestic travelers pick up the slack coming to see those new-look Cubs. They can't field or hit, apparently.
The
yet.
Look will be new soon, we hope.
So basically, it's like they're just cutting their losses, right?
I mean,
and they're just exiting and going to China. But what's amazing to me is that I'm feeling like there are more hotel rooms now in Chicago than ever before.
Yeah.
And are we going to have a lot of empty rooms, do you think?
Yeah, that's the bad part of the timing is just, and it's cyclical, but just in this time when the dollar is getting stronger and it's going to impact foreign travelers. Chicago hoteliers have been on the building boom, adding 1,000 rooms this year. It's an increase of almost 3%. So there could be some good hotel deals for, you know, your cousin from Schenectady.
Or for one of those staycations.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
Maybe like domestic that. Travel will make up the difference. This is a big deal because, as I understand it, international travelers, those tourists spend a lot more money here in Chicago than the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, they're coming here. It's just like when you go on vacation, you get enticed into those boutiques, you know, open your wallet in ways you might not when you're home. And, you know, they're coming in with higher budgets overall than the domestic travelers. Yeah.
Finally, a Cranes interview with the author of a new biography on Michelle Obama. And what do we expect from this book? It's out tomorrow, I believe.
That's right. Michelle Obama, A Life by Northwestern University Professor Peter Slevin. He did not, it's an unauthorized biography, so he didn't have her cooperation, but he used to cover her for the Washington Post and has interviewed her several times and interviewed people close to her for the book. It sounds like it's a fairly positive portrayal of the First Lady. One of the things he talks about is how competitive she is. We've all seen that. She learned about Princeton through her older brother, Craig, and said, if he can get in, I can get in. And, you know, even the president jokes about how competitive she is. One of the other things that is highlighted in the book is, you know, we all know that she is more popular often than the president, very popular across the country. But Slevin said he did not fully grasp the amount of real hatred that she endures, the internet comments, the racist jokes. He said it's awful and it continues. So that aspect of it, maybe not highlighted as much as it should be, will be focused on in the book. And And the other thing that the most surprised him, he said, was that she had a close relative who was chiefly influential in integrating Chicago department stores back in the day. And she was responsible for hiring hundreds of African-Americans back then. And then she had another relative who sued Northwestern for racial discrimination in the 40s. So definitely comes from a family that was all about getting the civil rights that they deserved.
And I wonder why, it doesn't sound like it's a negative portrayal of her unless she minds being called competitive.
Right, exactly.
And unless she minds all these lawsuits coming to light. Why would she not cooperate with something like this?
Well, I mean, as somebody who's written a book where the subjects cooperated, I've always said, no matter how, when you go into these things, if you ever cooperate on a biography of yourself or your company, you're crazy to do it. I hate to say that.
Oh,
because
really?
You're going to hate it. I mean, if somebody...
You're talking about your Groupon book.
Yeah, but I mean, I think any book like that, if you did something on me or I did something on you, as much as we like each other and get along, you'd read it and you would cringe. So I think that a lot of politicians are very savvy. They just don't want to get anywhere near that, even if it is a positive portrayal.
The thing about Michelle Obama, I don't know whether they go into it in this book, but because Marianne does some media training through her circles, we heard early on about the transformation Michelle Obama had to do. People forget about this, and not too many folks talk about this anymore, but her image has softened quite a bit from what it was during the campaign even.
Absolutely. And the author talks about that. He says, obviously it can't have been easy for her to give up her career to be the candidate's wife and to be the first lady. But even while she softened her approach and her public persona, he says she's always found a way to pursue issues and interests that she cares about. So he's really curious, as am I, to see, what's going to happen with Michelle Obama after they leave the White House and she's fully unleashed again. I bet there's going to be a lot of good stuff, interesting stuff coming from her.
And the new biography out tomorrow.
That's right.
Frank Sennett, Mr. Digital Chief over there at Crane Chicago Business. We'll talk to you next Monday. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Let's get to the business of hashtags, likes, and shares now from the Tribune's Metro Mix and Red Eye and WGN Radio. Amy Guth is here. Hi, Amy.
Hello. How are you?
Hi there.
Hi.
We are reading, like everybody else, about this Rolling Stone retraction, and I imagine that is the big buzz on social media, isn't it?
Indeed. It is a big story today in that Rolling Stone ran this story about a very, very brutal, brutal rape incident that happened at University of Virginia campus, and has since retracted it. And at this point, they're saying there's no disciplinary action that's going to be happening against its author and the reporter who wrote it. She issued a statement, really, apologizing and saying that, to any victims of sexual assault who may feel fearful as a result of my article, I am very sorry. It's really, it's an interesting thing because I think a lot of times people question how do we know the things that we know in the media? Those of us in this business understand what how to source something, how to do all of that. But I think this is an inside look to a lot of people outside of this industry because of the Columbia University released this review of this story saying, hey, there's some basic tenets of journalism that were grossly overlooked in this story. We need to do better. So yeah. It really kind of quickly fell apart, but it is a very interesting look. I mean, just the story arc of the story itself is very interesting.
And for people who didn't read the story, what was any of it true?
Well, she hard to say. It's hard to say what is true and what is not, just, and that's kind of the nature of this. So the woman identified as Jackie as the victim of this crime. As it was pointed out, the reporter didn't talk to her friends. There were some very basic things she didn't do that was pointed out in Columbia.
As reported, it was not true,
right,
as she reported it. And now the controversy, and I imagine this is what's happening on social media, the debate, should the woman keep her job or not?
Right. That is the big debate. I think there's lots of people on social media saying this is absolutely irresponsible. This woman should not be in this business. And some people say, rookie mistake. She's obviously just learned a very big lesson and it will not happen again. But, it'll be interesting to see what happens the next few days with this one.
Tell us about this political mistake. Is that what it is involving Jeb Bush?
So Jeb Bush, according to a 2009 voter registration application that was obtained from Miami-Dade County Election Department, he marked that he, under race ethnicity, he checked the box that said Hispanic. Well,
that was once he did it one time, or he always does that.
It was the one time. But you know, he is identifying as you know, for he's certainly, you know, like connected to the, and he's bilingual, but that doesn't make you Hispanic per se.
Yeah, and right? isn't his wife?
I think his wife is Mexican.
His wife is from Mexico,
yeah,
right?
And his children are half Mexican,
right? Mm-hmm. But again, doesn't make him Hispanic. So
exactly.
On Twitter, he has claimed, "Oh, my bad, you know, wrong. Check the wrong box. I'm a goof." You know, and his dad was kind of giving, or his dad, I'm sorry, his son was giving him a little bit of grief about that, like, "Hey, Dad, pay attention," you know. And they're trying to kind of downplay the whole thing, but you know, during an election season, a mistake like that can be very costly because it can look, you know, it can certainly look like it's giving the wrong impression.
But I think this issue is early enough on so that people will probably forget. We'll have 10 more issues to
certainly
talk about.
Oh, something worse will come along and you know, and trump this.
Yeah.
But it's kind of similar to like how Ted Cruz had to explain, you know, his birth in Canada, and Elizabeth Warren maybe had overrepresented her Native American heritage, according to some people. So it's just yet another thing. As you run for office, a lot of dirt is dug
yes
on you, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Dirt even from 2009.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about this Jay-Z music streaming service. And it's not just Jay-Z, right? Isn't Rihanna a part of this? Or
lots of
Kanye
artists.
West,
yeah, lots of artists. But he's the guy behind it, really. It's called Tidal. And it's a music streaming service. It's similar to like Spotify and Pandora, that kind of thing, where you don't have to own the physical, you know, CD, that kind of thing.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what's different about it is that, like, unlike Spotify and Pandora, there's not a free version. So to be involved in this, you got to pay $10 a month. There's a premium version of it that's $20 a month. You know, iTunes recently found that the average user only spends about $12 a year on music. So asking people to fork over like $240 a year, that's pretty steep. That, you know, but he's claiming that it's this lossless audio file. He's calling it free lossless audio codec. That technology is involved in this, and it's supposed to be a very, very high quality of sound. You know, early adopters here are saying, you know, unless you have really, really great equipment that you're listening to this on, unless you have really good speakers or headphones or whatever, or you are a professional and know what the heck you're listening for, that sound quality is really negligible in the difference.
My take on it is also that they're trying to put the word out there, that Jay-Z is trying to put the word out there that music should not be for free. And then so if people, it's almost like you're doing the right thing by using this streaming service as opposed to a free one, because then the artists are getting somewhat compensated, right?
Right. He's certainly pushing the narrative that he's calling this artist-owned, and I'm doing the air quotes on that one, because he's really, you know, a lot of artists have decried all the, you know, music streaming services as, hey, look, I make $0 on this. This is not feasible. I think any time a big digital, you know, tidal wave, no pun intended, hits an industry, it is always interesting to see, because there's always people that say, absolutely not, we're going to do something else, or we're going to just kind of put our hands on top of our stacks of papers and not let them go anywhere. And then there's people that say, you know what, the business model has changed, let's do something mm-hmm. else. I mean, we saw this with the first round of digital disruption in music, where we saw people saying, okay, fine, download my stuff, I'm going to make money from live shows and merchandise, that's cool, we're going to adapt. And then we saw bands like, most notably, Metallica sued the bejesus out of everybody who had mm-hmm. access to their music. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this next wave of things shakes out in the music world.
More music than ever being downloaded, and the artists are getting less money mm-hmm. for it. That's why all this is happening in the business world of music. Finally, let's talk about two statue stories circulating on social media. What's this all about?
Well, let's see. There are two interesting statue stories, and one of them is that artists have secretly installed an Edward Snowden statue in a Brooklyn park. It was kind of under the cover of darkness. People dressed in this reflective yellow construction gear put this bust of Edward Snowden, but it's atop a column at the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument in Fort Greene. And that's a site, and it was built to prisoners of war that were killed on British ships during the American Revolutionary War. And so, you know, there's obviously a big political statement being, you know, attached to that, right? So that's happening. The signs labeling it as Edward Snowden Monument have already been taken down by the park. So that's one that's happening. The other one that's happening is there's a Lucille Ball statue in outside of Buffalo that's been there for a while. It's been there for several years. And just in the last week or so, someone created a Facebook page asking for it to be taken down. The Facebook page is called We Love Lucy, Get Rid of This Statue. Because you know what? It really does not look like Lucy.
It
really doesn't. People have compared it to Conway Twitty.
The
snake from Beetlejuice, Steve Buscemi, a zombie. I mean, it's not people being mean to Lucy.
It shouldn't be taken down. It should be replace it.
It should be replaced.
Yeah. Fixed.
So public officials in that community are saying, look, we don't really want to put the taxpayer dollars to fixing, you know, plastic surgery for this statue's face. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't look like Lucy. So there's a lot of people kind of up in arms about that. But none of them are Lucy haters. They're all big fans of Lucy, just saying, like,
that's
look.
That's good to hear.
I mean, it really does not, you know, if you Google this picture, it really doesn't look like her at all.
All right. Amy that's Guth funny. With the statue news on social media and more. Thanks, Amy, as
Thanks,
always.
Amy.
Here's a subject that has fascinated me and also Marianne for a long time. Every once in a while, you hear about people blogging and making money. And how this happens, I don't know. Maybe we can find out right now, though. Because with us is Kit Graham and Aaron Bassett of the Windy City Blogger Collective. That's what it is. Kit and Aaron, welcome. Kit, why don't you begin by telling us what the Blogger Collective is?
Professional organization for bloggers. We have over 250 members in the Chicago area, and we put together a lot of events for our members, and we also help pair them with opportunities with brands.
And Aaron, talk a little bit about how there are 70 billion blogs out there, and a few of them seem to come to the forefront and get popular, and people make money.
Yeah, so what kind of bloggers are we talking about? Are we talking about moms who are blogging about, you know, their everyday things, or are we talking about major corporations?
Most of ours are personal blogs, so we have members who write about fitness, food, travel, general lifestyle, fashion. We have mom bloggers. So most people have started with, they've got a story to share, they have a personal voice, and they probably have some good photography skills and get that information and that content out.
How do you turn a blog into a profit-making business? What's the secret?
Oh boy, that's
see,
a stumper,
gotcha, huh?
See? it takes a lot of work. It's a lot of hustle. You have to be putting yourself out there constantly. A lot of times what we see from our members that have kind of a business mix with their blog, so they'll do other things besides just posting to their website. They'll do speaking engagements, they'll do events and workshops, they'll go to conferences and kind of be featured there. So you get, it's almost like being a personality, and you're then compensated for that voice that you have.
But I don't understand, like, so give us an example of a personal blogger who, say, blogs about fitness. How can that person end up doing the speaking engagements and being involved and becoming a personality?
Yeah, so first and foremost, you have to create your own voice, and then you have to get readership. And then once you have a strong amount of followers, you can work with brands that will pay you X amount of dollars to write about their product or to host an event at their fitness studio or to go on a trip and blog about some event. There's a lot of different opportunities out there, but you have to put the work in and really know your readership and bring them what they're looking to read about, and then you have the perfect combination.
So then how do you get the readership? How do you get people to follow you? How do you get the word out?
Because that's the big question. It really comes from being authentic. The people that have been most successful are able to get their information out there on various social channels. You can join different networks to help push your content along. So Kit writes about recipes, and hers have been picked up by like MSNBC and different like food sites that'll do, you know, 12 favorite mac and cheeses, and Kit's will be featured in that, and that drives traffic to your website. It adds to your numbers, and then you know, brands can come back to you and say, okay, well, we see that you have a strong followership, you have a voice, we want you to advocate for our product.
So if I blog about a fried salami sandwich, which is the only thing I make really, do I just have to hope somebody with a huge following picks up on that?
That could help, but you also need to constantly be creating new content.
I got to make something else besides fried salami sandwiches.
Yeah.
Right. Every day of the week, you need a new version on your fried salami sandwich.
I get it.
But that could take off.
Yeah. And then what about how do the brands find you? Like if I'm blogging about whatever it is, how did they find me, or do I go and pursue them?
It's both. And they find me everywhere. Sometimes it will be Instagram, sometimes word of mouth. They read my site, they follow me on Facebook, they saw something I tweeted. And then there's other brands where I have an idea about summer grilling, and I'm going to write to brands about getting a new grill for the summer so I can write about
grill. But this is because you have a ton of followers, right?
Yeah.
Is there one medium that works better than the others in terms of getting brands? Is it Twitter over Facebook or over Tumblr?
It depends on the brand. Everyone's a little different, I think.
And how does the Windy City Blogger Collective work? How do I get in there with my fried salami blogging?
Well, we have two main criteria. It's you have to be in the Chicagoland. We define that pretty loosely.
All right,
and
I'm in there. So far I qualify.
Okay, so check one. And then you do have to have a blog that we can visit. So you will have to get those fried salami sandwiches actually published. But once you have those up, you're welcome to join.
What do you mean I have to have a blog you can visit? I just have to start a blog.
Just start a blog.
Yeah,
they can send it to us and then we have to see it.
Yep. And does it matter if it's on Tumblr or if it's on anything else?
No, the sites that seem to do well and look better and more polished typically have their own like dedicated URL. But we have .wordpress.blogspot.tumblr. Whatever you want to.
Complete mix.
Yeah.
Interesting business and continued success to you. Kit Graham and Aaron Bassett of the Windy City Blogger Collective. And Aaron, since you're from Wisconsin, you'll be watching basketball tonight.
Yes,
right?
I will be. I'll be staying up late.
Good luck. And thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Bob Sherrod and Marianne Murciano on 720 WGN.